Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Frank A. von Hippel. He's a professor of ecotoxicology at Northern Arizona University. We're talking about his book, The Chemical Age, How Chemists Fought Famine and Disease, Killed Millions, and Changed Our Relationship with the Earth. Frank, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your interest in it.
This is a book that sort of surprised me. I thought it was going to be one kind of a history, and it turned out to be a much more interesting, fascinating history. It really is about how the sort of scientific chemical research for insecticides and things to put down insect pests that may carry disease has sort of dovetailed a little bit too closely with the chemical warfare business. Talk to me about coming across this subject matter, because it's a fascinating subject and an important one.
Yeah, so it is a really interesting interplay that occurred between the development of pesticides, where people were trying to fight insect vectors of disease, and also trying to fight famine, because famines are caused by insects and other animals that eat our food stock, and also by plant pathogens that kill the crops. So scientists were trying to develop effective chemicals to combat both famine and disease, but many of these brilliant people also developed chemicals to kill people, chemical weapons. And a lot of the pesticides were then kind of converted into chemical weapons, and many chemical weapons were converted into pesticides. So that part of the interface between warfare and public health kinds of developments is really striking.
The book starts out interesting. It starts out with the potato blight, 1586 to 1883. And it sort of sets the stage for the next couple of chapters, where there's an important problem that happens either to the food supply or to our health. And first people have to identify what that is that's causing the problem. And then there's the development of a sort of a chemical treatment for it. Let's start with the potato blight. If it's people who aren't familiar about how serious that was for people in countries like Ireland, it's amazing the people that starved because of this fusarium, I think it's called.
Yeah, the Phytophthora infestans is the name of the pathogen. It's a water mold, kind of like a fungus. And really, the situation in Ireland was a famine due to social conditions. Just about all famines, actually, are because of social conditions, not because of any inherent lack of food. But in the case of Ireland, the peasant class of Ireland, which was over 90% of the population, they were living on marginal lands where they were growing crops for absentee British landlords. And their subsistence crop was the potato. And the potato provides just about all the nutrition you need. You need a little bit of protein besides that, so maybe a little bit of meat or milk or something like that. But essentially, you can live on the potato. And the Irish population subsisting on the potato in these marginal lands just exploded in size. And they were set up for this vulnerable condition of famine because they were living on a monoculture, the potato. And the blight arrived probably with seed stock coming over from the United States to Europe, and it then infected fields all over Europe. But the only place where it caused widespread famine was in Ireland because of that reliance on the monoculture. So over a million Irish people died in the famine, and over a million Irish people emigrated from Ireland to British North America, which is now Canada, to the United States, Australia, to England, and so on. So it really changed the course of events for Ireland. It also changed the course of events for places like our country, where we have a large Irish immigrant population.
And then the chapters that follow it, chapters on malaria, yellow fever, typhus, the bubonic plague, are fascinating. Each chapter we could devote a show to. What was a little bit upsetting for some of these is the use of human subjects. It was fascinating to me about these people who were trying to either prove that the pathogen was transmitted by a mosquito, that they would actually use humans as experimental subjects.
That's right. So human experimentation was common, and typically wasn't even with the permission of the person being experimented on. And the very first case of researchers using some kind of informed consent process was the Reed Commission trying to sort out the cause of yellow fever, which was right at the turn of the century in Cuba. And it was a, you know, basically a very simple thing of asking people if they would volunteer. They really didn't understand the risks, but they actually used a form and had people sign it. And that was the first time in medical research that that occurred. So it is striking how much experimentation was done on people, and typically without their knowledge of what was going on or their permission.
And then the story, I think, really sort of almost changes dramatically as the book progresses, because you start to have use of chemicals in warfare. Now, you make the point that chemicals for warfare didn't start with World War One. That even back to ancient Greece, I think it was, or not maybe that far back, but there was the villain of things like Greek fire and sulfur ships. So people have been using chemicals in warfare for a while.
That's right. So chemicals in warfare were mostly flame-based kinds of chemicals, and they do go back to ancient times, even to the battles between Athens and Sparta. But things didn't really develop to the extent where they could be considered modern chemical weapons until around the time of the American Civil War, when people started proposing the use of things like chlorine in chemical weapons. And chemical weapons were not used in any real sense on the battlefield as a weapon of mass destruction until World War One.
But what you point out is that it really took the sort of a rapid progress in organic chemistry to start to really develop focused chemical weapons. One of the things, first things, that it led to an accidental synthesis of urea from cyanic acid, right?
That's right. So Frederick Wohler in 1828 accidentally synthesized urea, and that was the birth of organic chemistry. Because before that, people thought that organic materials could only be produced by the vital forces of nature. They weren't possible to synthesize. And Wohler showed that actually they can be synthesized. And ever since then, we've had a dizzying array of chemicals synthesized by chemists. At this point, we've probably had chemists synthesize something like 150 or 200,000 chemicals that have been introduced into the environment, to the marketplace.
Now, in 1914, Germany dominated the field of chemistry. And your story, there's a lot of different aspects and a lot of different threads that run through it. But I want to talk about two people. Fritz Haber, is it Haber or Haber?
I say Haber, but okay. I've heard it pronounced both ways.
Okay, Haber. And Walter, is it Nernst?
That's right.
Talk to me about these two people. And at that time period, they were competitive chemists. And what were they trying to do?
Right. So Haber and Nernst were the two greatest physical chemists in Germany and therefore in the world, because Germany led chemistry just as they led so many other fields of science. And they were competing to solve basically world hunger, because at that time, the agriculture around the world was limited by the availability of nitrogen. Most of the world's nitrogen fertilizer came from caliche deposits in Chile. And so they had to be mined in Chile and then transported to wherever their farming was occurring. And this limitation to agriculture meant that people were constantly starving due to lack of food. So both Haber and Nernst wanted to be able to synthesize ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen. So the atmosphere is composed of about 80% nitrogen. And if they could figure out a way to get that nitrogen out of the air, to essentially mine it from the air, they could solve world hunger. So it was an incredibly important endeavor. And they were both playing around with incredibly high temperatures and incredibly high pressures. And the importance of pressure to chemistry had only been discovered
right.
about 10 years before this. And Haber got there first. And the reason Haber got there first is he was brilliant at figuring out what's the perfect catalyst for a reaction. And so he was the one who made economical levels of ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen first. And because of that, he became the most famous chemist in the world.
Now, time and again, there's, and you talk about this, how these discoveries often had serious unintended consequences. So here's Germany in World War One, and they're not doing well. So they start to turn to scientists to try to give them something that they can sort of get a leg up in the war effort. And so naturally, they turn to Haber and Nernst. And they assigned Nernst the task of developing effective chemical agents to use as weapons. What did the public think about chemical weapons at the time?
So Germany was a signatory to the convention banning the use of chemical weapons, and most people viewed them very negatively. And it's an interesting story that happened there, because Nernst was assigned this task, and he had some ideas about how to make an effective chemical weapon, but the weapons that he developed were ineffective. And I've always wondered whether he purposely did not develop an effective chemical weapon, because here's this man who was so brilliant. It just seems inconceivable to me that he couldn't pull this off. But he did not develop an effective chemical weapon, and so the Kaiser replaced him in his position with Haber. Haber had just developed an effective antifreeze for the German military, which was important to them to fight through the winter on the Russian front. And so Haber was given the task then to develop the chemical weapon arsenal for Germany.
Now, what happens is, wait a minute, let me back up a bit. In your book, I remember reading people going like, well, actually, chemical weapons aren't that bad. It's a more humane way for people to die. And people were using that excuse so they could still use chemical weapons.
Yeah, in fact, what so many people said who were on the pro-chemical weapon side is this will be a way to stop war forever, because chemical weapons are so horrendous that nobody will dare start a war if there's going to be chemical weapons involved. So it's sort of like what happened later with nuclear weapons, where we actually had this Cold War. It wasn't full-out war. It wasn't full-on peace, but we had this Cold War because the Soviet Union and the United States realized they would have mutual annihilation with nuclear weapons. In the same way, many people argue that if we develop chemical weapons, it will stop war forever because it'll be too horrific for any side to attack any other side.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Frank A. von Hippel. He's a professor of ecotoxicology at Northern Arizona University, and we're talking about his book. It's a really interesting and important history, The Chemical Age, How Chemists Fought Famine and Disease, Killed Millions, and Changed Our Relationship with the Earth. So Haber ends up supervising the release of 150 tons of chlorine gas on April 22nd, 1915 in Belgium. Talk to me about that. There's an amazing description of the effect that had on people.
Yeah, so Haber had the idea that if the German military deployed chlorine gas, that they could break through the stalemate of World War One and break through the line. And he also considered this to be an important thing to do because Germany was resource limited, whereas the rest of the world, especially if the United States got involved with the war, would not be limited in its resources in the same way. So Haber felt that Germany had to break through quickly in order to end the war quickly. He thought that the deployment of chlorine gas would enable the war to end much more quickly than otherwise and thereby save lives. Chlorine gas is heavy, and so it stays near the ground. And he had worked out at his laboratory the exact conditions needed in order for it to be an effective weapon.
Right.
And essentially, if he could see grass blowing in the wind was too strong. So they had to wait for the gentlest of breeze, and it had to be blowing towards the Allied lines, the French colonial troops, the British troops there in Belgium. And so they deployed it. And the soldiers at the time described hearing more gunfire than they'd heard at any other time in the war as this cloud was slowly marching towards the Allied forces. They started firing guns and artillery into it at an unbelievable rate.
So they're actually just firing into the gas?
Exactly. And, of course, that wouldn't work. It wouldn't do anything. Some of the troops fled. Others charged into the gas, and they, of course, died. And so there were thousands of casualties in that first attack. But it was, in a sense, an ineffective attack because the German military scoffed at the idea that an academic would tell them what to do. And so they were not prepared to break through the lines that were broken by the gas. And then we got into the tit for tat of chemical warfare during World War One.
A couple of things happened at that time too. Haber's wife viewed the poison gas as barbaric, and not for that reason alone, she ended up committing suicide.
That's right. So after the victory by Germany and Belgium, Haber and his colleagues were celebrating at his mansion, and his wife Clara took his service revolver out into the garden and shot herself in the head, killed herself. And actually, she was found by their 13-year-old son, Herman, as she was dying in their yard. That very night, Haber went to go fight on the Eastern Front.
Now, it probably wasn't just due to that, though, right? Because wasn't he having an affair at the same time?
Yeah, there were a couple things going on. So one was that Clara herself was a talented chemist, and she gave up her career to marry him. So I think she was frustrated in her inability to do what she loved to do, and Haber was having a dalliance with his future wife. So there were multiple things going on, but she also strongly opposed his development of chemical weapons.
Now, when the gas masks, how quickly did they come along after the development of the gas?
So gas masks were actually around in the middle of the 19th century, long before World War One.
Okay.
And actually the development of gas masks was also involved self-experimentation by the inventors and their students. So they would expose themselves to things like chlorine and other toxic gases in order to see how effective the masks were. But of course, the gas mask technology improved dramatically and rapidly during World War One because it became a chemical war. By the end of World War One, a quarter of the artillery shells had chemical weapons in them, and they were the chemical weapons had developed so quickly that they included agents that would make the soldiers tear up and sneeze, so they would rip off their gas mask and then inhale the deadly gas. You can see photos of horses and dogs and carrier pigeons wearing gas masks. I mean, all kinds of animals were outfitted with gas masks in addition to the soldiers.
And then mustard gas was developed, which was a contact irritant, right?
That's right. It was also developed at Haber's lab, and it was also first used in Belgium, and the British then went on a rapid development to try to make their own version of mustard gas. It took them about a year to synthesize mustard gas. It was led by a British scientist named Pope. And once the British had it as well, then we had mustard gas being lobbed in both directions in artillery.
It's amazing to read the figures quoted in your book about how many chemists were involved in this research. What, as quote from your book, 1/3 of the 17,000 chemists in the United States worked for the federal government on the war effort. Now, I'm sure not all of them by any means were working on the development of poison gas, but it's amazing how many chemists were involved in the war effort.
That's right. In fact, a lot of historians of World War One say that the chemists played the most important role of the war. So it's not just the chemical weapons, but if you think about Germany's ability even to make explosives, which are necessary for all of the artillery and the firepower, that relies on nitrate as well. And the reason they had nitrate was because Haber developed the process to pull it out of the air. So the chemists were essential for the development of all of the weapons, not just the poison gas weapons.
But again, there's this weird connection between poison gas for people and the eradication of pests. And there was even parallels between gas warfare and pesticide. You have an interesting illustration in your book. I mean, people looked at that as similar.
They did. And in fact, the propaganda during both the world wars included a lot of propaganda around pest extermination, where the pests were the opposing forces. So that was a way to dehumanize people in order to justify the use of these poison gases against them. But the poison gases developed during World War One also gave rise to the very first organic pesticide that was commercialized after the war, and then there were lots of chemicals that were commercialized, and also chemicals that had already existed, like hydrocyanic acid, before World War One, were as pesticides, as insecticides, were modified and became important to the World War One gas arsenal.
After the war, both Haber and Nernst received Nobel Prizes in chemistry.
They did, and so...
But Haber's was contested. I think, isn't that the only example in history of a Nobel Prize being contested?
It's the only example of a Nobel Prize in science being contested.
Wow.
So I think there have been Nobel Peace Prizes contested, but never a Nobel Prize in science other than Haber's. So his was an incredibly contentious one because he was best known after the war for his development and implementation of chemical warfare. So his reputation outside of Germany was completely demolished. And yet he was given the Nobel Prize for this thing that he did to avert world hunger of making artificial fertilizers from the atmosphere. So it's an incredible opposition there, an incredible dichotomy between a scientist who did something that averted mass starvation on the one hand just before the war, but then also initiated weapons of mass destruction during the war.
Perhaps one of the most disturbing things in your book is the development of Zyklon and then Zyklon B. In between the wars, Haber devotes himself to the production of insecticides derived from especially hydrocyanic acid, and he becomes the chairman of TASCH, Tosh. And they're developing insecticides to fight lice, right? And they develop these fumigation vans to fumigate people's clothes. Talk to me about that whole interesting history.
Yeah, so after World War I, Haber wanted to redeem his reputation. And one of the things that he did to try to redeem himself was to work in public health, develop hydrocyanic acid into an effective insecticide that could be used against the body louse. And this was critical because the body louse transmits typhus as well as other deadly diseases. And they were effective. They made this gas. They had to pull it off of the market for a few years because it actually ended up violating the Treaty of Versailles, since hydrocyanic acid was a war gas that was developed into an insecticide. But then one of the chemists at his company changed it a little bit in its structure and made it a little more effective against the body louse, and it got back on the market as an insecticide. It was then used all over the world under German direction to kill the body louse in places like barracks and prisons and ships as an important public health tool. And in Germany in particular, they developed gas chambers that people could go in and get their all their possessions deloused so that they would not get typhus. And this was done under a program that was under highly trained personnel that had to be certified by Germany. Unfortunately, this then morphed into the killing gas of the Nazi extermination camps, which is obviously a terrible outcome for this public health benefit that Haber was trying to do.
Well, initially they had to add a chemical that would have a smell to Zyklon.
Warn people.
Turn on gas in your house.
Yeah, exactly. And so they added this warning label so that because it's dangerous, so that the applicators would know when it's being sprayed, people would know, and they wouldn't get exposed to it. And what the Nazis did is they had the company, by this time Haber was no longer involved, but they had the company remove the warning label so that they could kill Jews and other targets of the Nazi annihilation in the termination gas chambers.
What happened to Haber and Nernst during World War II and the rise of Hitler in Germany?
Well, with Nernst, he lost both of his sons to combat during World War I. And after the war, he devoted himself to his science because it was kind of his only refuge. He had three daughters, two of them married Jewish men. And so when the Nazis rose to power, of course, they were in danger. They managed to escape. Haber, one of the interesting things about Haber's story is that he resigned his position as the head of the Institute of Physical Chemistry and Electrochemistry at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute because of the treatment of the Jews. And he figured he was too old really to do anything at that point. And he was invited by Pope to come to England and work in his lab, which was remarkable because he was just a short while earlier considered really the chief enemy of the British for starting the chemical war of World War One.
Wow.
He then was offered a position as a professor in Israel, or at that time it was in the British Mandate in Palestine by Chaim Weizmann, who would later become the first president of Israel. And Weizmann was a biochemist. He was recruiting talent of Jewish refugees from Nazi-occupied Europe, and he offered Haber a position. And initially, Haber declined, but then he decided that, he would do that. It was kind of his only option. And he decided to take a three-day break in Switzerland on his way to Palestine, and on the third day, he died.
Wow. Now, we're almost completely out of time, and there's so much more. There's a very important chapter on Rachel Carlson that ends this book. And the very last chapter of this book, and I don't want to give this entirely away, I don't know if you meant it, but to me it seemed like a surprise ending. It's like, because you end up being personally involved in this story too.
Yeah, so I did mean it to be
Don't give it all away.
Okay, I did mean it to be a surprise, and I was careful when I talked about people in the book to not give too much away, so that when the reader comes to the epilogue, they would find it different. And part of that is I made the writing style different of the epilogue.
You do it in first person.
That's right.
People are going to have to read the book, because it was a total surprise to me, and that has to be the impetus for you to write this book.
It is, and without giving too much away, I grew up hearing many of the stories that I discuss in the book.
My guest tonight has been Frank A. von Hippel. He is the professor of ecotoxicology at Northern Arizona University. He's been talking about his book. It's an important science history, The Chemical Age, How Chemists Fought Famine and Disease, Killed Millions, and Changed Our Relationship with the Earth. Frank, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.